We're back with another episode of the Lean Into Art Cast, the show for, well, let's say this time, who the show is for. In past episodes, we say who we are and what the show is about, but who is this for? This is for self-learners, visual storytellers, whether you're a cartoonist, a painter, a presenter, if you got a talk that you got to do. We're going to probably talk a little bit about doing talks today at the tail end of this episode, but if you communicate visually, and you are a self-learner, you are somebody who doesn't necessarily want to go back to school to do this stuff, but you keep pursuing new ways to think about the kind of communication you do, this is the show that is made for you and you alone. And my name is Jersey, and that other guy is...
I'm Rob. Hey.
Hey. So... Structurally, for new listeners, and by the way, everybody who's given us star reviews on iTunes to help spread the word to new listeners, thank you very much. Keep doing that. That makes us very happy. But for new listeners, the structure of the show runs as follows. We start out with a curveball where we throw a difficult question at one another or a question that is doesn't have a clear answer to it. And the goal of the exercise is to get the other person to think really hard until they go, I don't know. Then we go 1,000 feet up into our main topic. Then we go down on the ground with practical usages based on the topic that we discuss. And then we close with some takeaways from our art week. So, Rob.
Yeah, Jersey.
Do you have a curveball?
Well, I don't have like the highly honed one or whatnot, but I am curious about your, let's see, it's super related to our topic. And we're thinking about being productive yet mobile, being nomadic. And I love that word nomad, you know, like no and mad, but you know, anyway, but it doesn't really, you combine it and it's not really that bad of a word. Okay. So I'm curious about, so in your process of being creative and nomadic, what led you to get the results that you were seeking? In that approach, or do you ever quite get there? Do you have to be also stationary and go back to home base where you can produce some of the work or a portion of it nomadically, and but it's really bolstered by also home base.
This is I feel like, and I don't know if this is a personal disposition thing, where if this is just who I am as a person, or if this is where I am in a path toward being fully nomadic. But I don't ever feel like I'm really there. I always feel like I'm in the pursuit of it, right? And I'm always tweaking and noodling and fudging with different things to get a little bit more mobility and get everything optimized just so. But it's like monkeying with a car or monkeying with your computer and always tweaking settings and never feeling like it's all the way there, right? When I was in my 20s, I became obsessed with ripping video. And this would be in like 2000, 2001, when it was still kind of hard to rip video. And I got like a TV tuner for my desktop computer, and I was, digitally ripping video from broadcast television shows. And then it became this hunt for the perfect compression settings, right? And I was using all sorts of different software, and it was, I could never leave well enough alone to go, well, MPEG 2 with this bit rate and this aspect ratio is just fine, right? Once I got it just fine, I had to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. That's how I feel about the nomadic thing. I got to keep tweaking with it. But that said, as it is right now, I've got it to where I can do all of the work that I do from home at my other office. To bring new listeners up to speed, I got a job at the University of Michigan as an artist in residence for a special program that they're doing where they gave me an office to work out of, and I've agreed to be there somewhere between 15 and 20 hours a week. And rather than just purchase a whole new fleet of art supplies, and they did give me a Mac to work on, and a scanner and a printer, and but they didn't give me a tablet, but they did provide me with all the software. They gave me the Photoshop Creative Suite and the FTP software that I requested and some other things. But in any case, there was a few things where I got to lug stuff there. I got to take my Wacom tablet there if I want to work drawing on the computer. Mm-hmm. And you know, I told them I'd bring my own paper, partially because I'm kind of uptight about what paper I use, not because I'm a snob, but because I found the paper that works best for me and I'm not deviating from it unless I have to.
So not everything's up for grabs when it comes to tinkering.
No, I guess not. I guess not. No. I've been using the Utrecht house brand Bristol for, oh my gosh, has it really been about 8 or 9 years now, I guess? And I love it. I absolutely love it. And it's the most versatile Bristol that I could find for my purposes. I mean, that's always the caveat, right? I'm not saying this is the best Bristol ever. This is the best Bristol for the way I use Bristol. So yeah, and plus I buy it by the, anyway, it's a long story, but there were some things that I had to lug there myself. So, and given that, you know, I'm not going to bring my hard drives and all my backups with me. I needed to investigate ways to create mobility between these, for my work. So I could just at a glance go, hey, page 3 of this thing I was working on, I need to pull that up on whatever Mac I'm working on. Right. And so that's where things like Dropbox, Box.com, Microsoft, SkyDrive come in. But also just improvising. Like, so I found out that, so here's an example. So, and I'm just going to show this quickly because this is actually for a book that I'm under NDA on. But
it looks like a really awesome looking page, but of course.
I'll flip it around. But yeah, so like this is the size paper I'm working on for this particular project, which is actually like about 9x14 legal size, as they say in the United States. And I have actually a Photoshop template that I print out. It's a blue line template that actually has the page cut into thirds and quarters, both horizontally and vertically. So it's easy to measure out my panel borders for general things, right? I never really stick to a grid, but for, you know, as a rule of thumb, it's nice to have those things there to give me a sense of, okay, this is halfway through the page kind of thing. Left it on my local machine. I was at the university. I didn't have access to it. I didn't have any remote desktop software running. So, you know, I fortunately had a previous page, and then I just broke out some rulers, copied the measurements off of that, and then just ruled it out by hand on the page. You know, little things like that you do as stop gaps. And then I made a mental note to myself, hey, when you get home, put that Photoshop template in your Dropbox. So I don't know. I don't know if that even answered your question. But
well, I think it points to that, a few different, yeah, I think you answered it. It illustrates for me how there's so many flavors of being nomadic and what, like for that, it sounds like you have a primary home for productivity, and then you can have a secondary home, like or a like your home base, and then a base camp or something like that, right? But it's not one of those things where I know that some folks will go to a coffee shop and maybe even vary where they go as far as having a portion of their work day or even most of it.
That is one thing that I noticed I'm getting slightly better at in the recent weeks of working in, like, because one of the things, I mean, and I don't know if I should say this for takeaways, but it took some getting used to working in an environment where people could come in and talk to me while I'm working after working from home for so long, but slate that for later. But the other thing is that I was so, and I know I've talked about this in other places, is I was so dependent on my comfort zone for getting into the real work of the day. Having a rhythm of, okay, well, from this time to this time is when I drink coffee and read the news, and then I go down to the studio from this time and work, and it's in my quiet studio, got my headphones on, I get to listen to whatever I want to, and not feeling like I could draw in any other environment. And you know, I don't know if that's a weakness or not, but that was the case. I feel like working in this other environment has gotten me, and especially with having deadlines and not having a choice, right? It's like you're in this other environment, you've got a deadline, this has got to be done today. You don't get to sit around and go, but this isn't my happy special place. Get the work done, kid.
Yeah. So, exactly. I'm slightly uncomfortable. Yeah. I don't feel like it.
Yeah, but so yeah, you get to work. So after doing that, I feel like I could, if I really wanted to, go to coffee shops to work. I tried that in the past. Like, if I have to go meet Anne on campus or something, I go stop into like a local coffee shop and I'd be like, well, while I'm here waiting, I'll just do some sketching. And it just felt weird being at this little tiny table. You know, I don't have my tools spread out the way I like them to be. That sounds dumb when I say it. And also, they're looking at me. Why are they looking at me? Don't look at me. You know, that kind of thing.
Rawr, I'm drawing here. Stay back.
So,
you know what? That's very fair. I mean, it's so. I'm going to save some of my reaction for takeaways too, because I think having a. I mean, why do we do all this? I think we do seek a process, and you do that to have it be repeatable. I mean, you can't just be productive out of nothing. I mean, you're finding the right, the kind of, you know, the skills, the things you're trying to put into your work. And I mean, at a certain point you want to rely on, you have enough variables as it is in dealing with, you know, getting through that creative act. You know, getting rid of a few of those variables is going to probably help you, especially if you've tested it and it's not, you know, you're just doing it out of superstition. You're like, no, really, this is the paper that solves problems. This mm-hmm. is the layout of my tools that solves problems, right? I'm getting stuff done. Anyway.
So, okay, well, then here I'm going to wind up with a counter curveball. And I don't want you to address it now. What I'm going to change things up. Just because I'm feeling that way, you know, like,
cool. That's fun. I'm with you. All right.
So, you know, the last couple episodes we've been saying after the curveball section, hey, you guys got a curveball for us that you want to stake on and try to make us chew on a little bit and go, I don't know. You can email us at leanintoart@gmail.com. You can send us an MP3 file. You can send us an email and just make sure to give yourself a web credit so we can give you proper credit when we read your stuff on the show. Yes. Well, I'm going to pitch the curveball at the listeners, at the leaners. So based on what you just said, we want to get into a rhythm with our stuff. We want to get into, you know, some kind of established workflow. What's the difference between that and a routine? And now a routine has positive and negative connotations. Some people say, well, I've got a routine for my day. Like I was alluding to earlier, but I drink my coffee and read the news. Then I go down and I work from this time to this time. But routine also can be a very negative thing. Routine can be in a sort of machine-like grinding without any sense of passion or inspiration, right? Now, I try to stay away from that inspiration word if I can, but in this case, I think it's a proper usage. What is the difference between, having a rhythm and a routine? Where is the line? And then, obviously, maybe if you guys want to share some of your tips on how you break out of a routine to get into a rhythm, or vice versa, you can email us at leanintoart@gmail.com. You can record an MP3 file and send it to us, or you can just type out an email, and we might read it on the show. And if you do send it to us, we just ask that you give yourself web credit so we can properly acknowledge your contribution to the show. How's that sound, Rob?
That sounds excellent.
So with that, are you ready to get into the main topic, go 1,000 feet up?
Yes, I am.
All right, well then I'll fire up the afterburners. And I'll pull the throttle back. What do they call that? What's that?
Are you quoting Panama?
What?
Are you quoting David Lee Roth speaking in Panama? I'm sorry.
Maybe if not. I am, would you fault me?
No. No.
But we got to go 1,000 feet up and talk a little bit philosophically about part two to our discussion on Toward a Paperless Studio. I'll just throw out at the top quick caveats. No, we're not talking about getting rid of paper altogether. We're not talking about getting rid of books. We're just talking about leaning on digital as a way to enhance our mobility and as a way to enhance expedite our work, right? And I think one of the things we're going to talk a little bit about today is digital assets in our work, which we may have brushed on a little bit in the past, but I think I'll kick it over to you as to where you feel like starting, Rob. What does your gut tell you? We got a million notes here, as I said last time.
Well, let's see. What if we did this in an order of sort of creating a comic page? We just followed it like a page creation process.
Okay.
So let's say you're working out, trying to find, let's see, let's say it's a new kind of page and you're working on trying to, you know, nail a good feel for it or whatnot, and reaching for, even things like color palette and trying to figure it out. there's some really cool, trying to think of the name of the search here. I'm going through the show notes. If you go to, labs.tineye.com, that can be a fun resource for looking for color-based photo reference.
Labs.tineye.com.
And essentially it's a search engine for images, but it's totally based on the looking at color as sort of the key ingredient of your search. And you can actually form a palette. You don't just have to say this photo has to be predominantly red or predominantly purple or whatever. You can say it's mostly green and black, right? It's pretty wild. That can be fun.
You're talking about starting out like really abstractly to,
yeah,
right? Like saying like, well, I don't even, all I've got is a few characters so far. Maybe I've got like a rough idea of a story, but maybe looking at color themes will be an insight into discovering where I want to go with it, or it'd be a way to unlock new things about the story that I didn't expect, or, you know.
Yeah, it's like, or think of it, there's so many different reasons why you would want to just play around exploring some photo reference, and then using color as the main motivation, where if you were just looking for pre-existing mixes of color as a way to strike that chord of well, here's the feel I want, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Actually, I like the tension of yellow and red. So I'm going to somehow incorporate that in the scene. Oh, maybe I should have a really garishly colored delivery van in the background. There's definitely some there's writing and whatnot going on in my example for sure, which could be because what's going to take place, but maybe you don't have the full scene down, kind of thing.
Yeah. Or even, have you watched the commentary featurettes or whatever you call them on the Amelie DVD?
No.
You've seen Amelie though, right?
Yeah, I have. It's been a while, but yeah, actually now I remember the color was super bold in that movie.
Yeah. And, on the DVD, if you watch the featurettes, there's some talking by the director about some of the deliberate color choices they made and how. And this isn't to emphasize what a genius he is because he overthinks everything, but just about how his deliberate attention to something can be an insight to you into, well, maybe I need to think about that, or maybe that'll give me a new way to think about this stuff. Digitally enhancing certain things in the scene. Like, if I remember right, there was a scene that was kind of like just bathed in green. There's so many green scenes in that film. And then I think Amelie's wearing red to contrast with the green. And then off to either the left or the far right, it was way off center, was this lamp. And the lamp was not blue, but they made it blue because they thought it complemented the scene. It added some kind of narrative clue in there, it keyed into something that was happening in the scene. I don't remember exactly, but I remember it being very, very interesting to listen to. I mean, there's a lot of that normal junk where it's like, watch us do the actor's hair and things like that. But there was at least a handful of little snippets where the director was saying something really interesting about color and how he thought about it in this film.
It's hearing someone else's design thinking, right? And sort of what were his goals, and even if he was doing some discovery about how the path he can take to achieve those goals. It's super cool and informative, I think, to hear someone navigating that.
Yeah.
Or describing their path through it.
Absolutely. I hadn't even thought about that. That's a really cool way of looking at it. It's just like, let's just do some color searching. And let's just do some color studying to see how it feels. You know, it's funny. I don't remember if I talked about this before, but I just did a class with my 12-year-olds where we did Stop me if I told this before, Rob, because my brain is like poi. But I had the kids pick a favorite character from a cartoon, movie, book, etc. And mm-hmm. they had to sketch out the character quickly, and then they had to take crayons and scribble out the predominant colors of that character, right? So if it's the Hulk, it's green and purple. If it's Captain America, mm-hmm. it's red, white, and blue, and so on. And then they had to do a sketch of the world in which those characters lived. And then they did, whatever primary colors you would find in that world. So like Manhattan, Spider-Man's in Manhattan, and this one kid did a whole wild variety of colors. And I said, why did you do so many colors? He said, well, Times Square. Another kid did Batman, all grays and blues and purples. You know, why did you do that? Well, it's Gotham. It's dark colors, you know, and it became an investigation into how the characters' colors either corresponded or contrasted with the world in which they lived, which was an exercise in thinking about world building, right? Through mm-hmm. color. But anyway, it gets me thinking about that too, right? It's like, what color is the world in which my characters live? And maybe this was on the extra show that we recorded recently, Rob. Maybe this is where I was telling this. But the kid who said that thing about the Punisher's world, did I tell you about this?
No, you did not. I wasn't trying to ignore stopping you. No, for sure, this is new. This is new.
Okay, thank goodness.
And all.
I'm starting to feel like a bad uncle, you know? It's like telling the same darn stories over and over again. So this one 12-year-old kid says, you know, in Spider-Man's world, he lives in New York, and it's very colorful because there's all those Times Square and all the lights and everything. And he said, but the same kid reads comics. He doesn't just watch the movies, he actually reads the comics. And he said, but when the Punisher's in New York, it's all grays and blacks and maybe some red every once in a while when there's blood, but it's not as colorful as Spider-Man. It's like, but it's still New York. And I at least, thank goodness, had the presence of mind to say, well, why do you think that is? And pitch it back to him. Like, well, what? That is weird. Let's investigate this. Why? And the kid said, well, I guess the Punisher's world is gray because the Punisher is gray, and that's the way he sees things. And Spider-Man's world is colorful because Spider-Man is colorful, and that's the way he sees things. And I was like, oh, awesome. You are only 12, but that was a really, really awesome insight. So it can be something like that too, right? It can be an investigation as to the tone of the scene. It can be an investigation of the actual feel of the world. Like when you look at I haven't watched much of it, but I've seen plenty of imagery and I've watched a little bit of Game of Thrones, different color palette than say Lord of the Rings.
Right? It's, and you can, let's see, you can have a color palette that is, you know, it's meant to be world-based or whatnot, but it also can just be, interesting, contrast or context, you know, for the scene specifically too. Mm. So sometimes, I'm pretty sure sometimes Spider-Man would visit a gray situation and sure. sometimes the Punisher in a colorful situation where now that would feel, you know, that would create a different feel than what you would be used to in the story.
Yeah. Obviously I'm speaking in generalities here, you know, it's a diagrammatic kind of thinking.
Yeah. I don't mean to, not being pedantic. It's just that it's, anyway, it's a fun thing to play with. And that is a fun tool to play with. Were you clicking through it at all while we're talking?
No, actually I hadn't, but anyway. Now I will.
Yeah, there's a, and I guess while on the topic of photo reference, I'll just mention a few others. There's and I use these a lot of times to just, I don't know, and feed abstract stuff into my brain to see what comes out, or I'll use it for podcast artwork, or I'm going to do a post and I need something that has Creative Commons artwork to include, or I need a reference because I'm going to draw something that I want to get capture more of that, more of what the source is, right? I mean, I'm especially trying to look up things like different kinds of clothing, because I really feel, and I've mentioned this on the show before, I think, I feel like my clothing vocabulary is needing improvement. So I find this very helpful Creative Commons licensed as a set of sources. I feel more comfortable in using them where like the creator intended for me to reuse this. Morgfile.com. It's pretty cool.
Oh, MORGUE.
Yep. File. Yep. .com.
Oh my. What is this? Do I get to throw out my photo morgue? Looking for high-resolution stock photos for your illustration comp or design needs? Search Morgue File for free reference images. Yes, they're all completely free. Whether you're an illustrator, art director, instructor, or looking to add a defining visual to your presentation, wonder why it's called Morgue File? Well, I don't need to ask that, but this is all free Creative Commons stuff?
I'm 80% sure yes on this one. I think some of it is... let's see, license. There we go. For sure, these other ones are
What?
You're free to remix commercial without attribution. Yep. Okay. There you go.
That is cool.
Cool.
So I'm going to search it right now. I mean, we're kind of getting into actual tool usage. So we're kind of going to ground.
I hacked the system, Jersey.
No, that's, well, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we want to cherish. I just did a search for shoes on Morgue File, and yeah, boom. A whole mess of really, really great photos of shoes pop up, and I'm sure I can get more specific. I'll do a more specific search now for Converse Chuck Taylor. Oh wait. No, didn't work.
Too specific.
Yeah, I'll look for a fishing boat.
I guess, okay. I do like the idea of stepping back because it is tempting to just, you know, jump into and swim in the tools and whatnot. because, I mean, they're handy. And then tools are one of the things that are like, I think they're easier for us to transmit and appreciate mm-hmm. among artists. I mean, they kind of translate the abstract stuff where you're like, hey, this is what I think about at this time of the process. And someone's like, you know, you're thinking too much or whatever. Whereas a tool, it's like, oh, neat. Everyone uses some kind of tools. Mm-hmm. So let's see, stepping back. Where would you like to start with the abstract?
The whole idea about the abstract is just to say the why. Why yeah. even bother with this stuff? Why even look into this mobility mm-hmm. thing? Because what if I'm the guy who has a home studio and that's the only time I get to work from home is between, you know, 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. when the kids are asleep. I don't have to worry about mobility. I don't have to worry about expediting things. Although I think that's where I would take issue with the counterpoint is the expediting things. And I don't even know if it's worth going into to fight that fight and say that making it harder doesn't make it better necessarily, right? I mean, do we even need to fight that fight? You know, I mean, it's self-evident.
Yeah. Talking about the like really worshiping a specific process and upholding it as somehow more legitimate than other processes. Let's see. I don't know. Like, I'm trying to devil's advocate that a little bit because I find myself trying new things sometimes purely for the sake of trying new things. And some might argue I'm addicted to trying out challenging things.
Yeah.
Which one way to have a challenge is to do something completely unfamiliar. So I remember last year, starting the, I participated in the Mini Comics dump truck. That was last year, right? Beginning of last year, I think. 2011. Anyway, probably. Yeah, no, 2011. Yeah, I think it was the beginning of last year. And it's a blur. And I ended up trying a bunch of different things. And partially because I had landed on a process that felt stable, but I felt like my learning was no longer as rapid as it once was. So I have a process for making an episode of Art Geek Zoo, right? And it's very much it's a familiar relative of all the different processes that the different creators that you pay attention to on the internet. Anyone who like, I'm saying this to me in New Jersey and everyone who's listening, where it's like, anyway, whatever. I go through steps, make an economic page in Photoshop. But then I thought, well, you know, I want to try something different. I have not. I've used natural media a lot in growing up and in my 20s and whatnot. But then slowly but surely, I just don't use it as much anymore. Even to the extent where I had I've had many episodes of Art Geeks that are just purely digital, start to finish. Anyway, so when it came time to tackle the Mini Comics dump truck, one of the things I do when I take on a new mini comic is I'm like, I'm trying something new because I want that exciting terror of like, how am I going to get this done or whatever. And then of course, looking for the benefit at the, out the other side, knowing like, oh, holy moly, this thing completely doesn't work for me, or eureka. Now I've got a new thing to add to my process or whatever. So yeah, anyway, I started trying a bunch of different natural media things, with that, anything from drawing on cardstock instead of just regular typing paper or printing, typing. Yeah, like I'm actually getting out a typewriter. Just let's see, that, trying out actually blue line pencils, red line pencils, and trying out the Pentel pocket brush pen for actual comics production. And I knew like at some point I was going to fall off the edge of like, I can't keep this purely analog because I want to print and distribute these somehow. And I really don't feel like doing that purely analog. But anyway, it was, let's see. What drives that process? Finding ways to learn. I suppose tying it back to our digital thing. Anything coming out of that that you're like, oh, that's interesting? Or,
well, yeah. I mean, the big idea is that it ties into like the whole idea of, like we said at the top, self learning, right? I mean, it kind of diffuses the whole self learning thing. And we talk about ruts and we talk about routines, right? Then we go back to, gosh, this is just a narrative throughout all of our shows, I guess. Like, we go back to when I was talking about being obsessed with finding the perfect video compression settings, right?
Yep. That
relentless pursuit of, well, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way to do this, right? I think that is, that it's something that needs to be there if you consider yourself a self-learner, a self-starter, or whatever, you know, tired old term you want to throw at that. But then also it is, investigating these new things can be a way to shake you out of the way that you have been looking at things. And the way that you have been looking at things might be perfectly serviceable. It might be that you're pretty happy with what you're getting out of it, but that little rocking sensation that you get when you try doing something completely different or with a different tool or trying in a different technique can fundamentally change your perspective and even improve your stuff by leaps and bounds and improve it in ways that you weren't even looking for, right?
And you just remind, like saying, you know, it, getting a different perspective, that is a huge motivation for me. And so one thing I discovered unintentionally was some of these analog techniques were more portable than what I had already been doing. Mm. So I was working with once in a while, depending on the situation, sometimes iPad, but most of the time ModBook to be portable, right? So I effectively had, you know, Cintiq, full Mac, wherever I'd go. Even if I went to local comic events and I was going to do some work on my comic, I would just bring my ModBook and pretty much have a portable studio right there. That's pretty nomadic. You know, I can essentially do what I define as my process wherever I went. But then all of a sudden I noticed some of these tools and stuff, these analog things I was using are more portable than a ModBook. I mean, they're lighter. They are more resilient to just being carried around. the ModBook, I was always nervous carrying that thing around. I bought a pretty nice case for it. Brent Haven. What was it? It was a sturdy thing though. I mean, incredibly, like I never bought it that nice of a case for any of my other laptops before, but in a way, carrying around a ModBook is like carrying around a laptop that you can never shut the lid.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that too. So like, yeah, the other day when I was out and I was downtown and I was going to see a talk, which maybe we'll talk about at the takeaway. I took the Galaxy Note with me because A, I was going to be waiting for my wife to get there. And I thought, well, I'll take my digital sketchbook. That's why I got it. I got to get my value out of this thing. So I should take it with me. And then if there's the opportunity to sketch arises, I've got the thing. And then also I thought, well, you know, the guy who I was going to see talk, is his talks are interactive. I might be able to, you know, like interact on Twitter or something while the talk is going on, et cetera. And then I get out of the car with this thing under my arm, and all I could think about is don't drop it, 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 don't drop it. And I thought, this sucks. I don't think about that when I'm walking around with a sketchbook. When I walk around with a sketchbook, it falls down. I'm just like, oh man, it got muddy. But if this thing fell out of my arms, it would not be oh man. It'd be all sorts of words.
It'd be very much a con moment. Yeah. Yeah. But these are interesting nuances, like the portability and to be able to work digital workflow. I know this is, I'm probably overemphasizing the portability aspect of a digital workflow. That was definitely part of the motivation for me.
I just watched the first presidential debate between our president and the other guy who wants to be president. And the other guy who wants to be president, one of the things he did that, everybody said, he did such a good job. One of the things he did from a public speaker standpoint, is that he told a lot of anecdotes. I know a boy in Wisconsin, right? That's always a way to get at, Rob's rolling his eyes. You know what I'm talking about. This is a narrative trick. You tell a little homespun Andy Griffith style story to show how much you care about everybody. Whether or not he's sincere, I don't know. I'm not making a judgment on that. I'm just saying it's a commonly used tool. So I'm going to do that now. Mini Comic Day back in March of this year. The whole idea is you sit down for 11 or 12 hours and you try to make a mini comic. And I put my hooves in the ground. And I said, well, if I'm going to make a mini comic, I'm going to make a good mini comic, and I'm going to make something that I can sell later on this year at shows. I'm going to put my back into this thing, and I'm going to try to get, I know I can't get a really good mini comic done in 12 hours, but I'm going to get most of it done. Already, I short-circuited the whole thing. Already, my hack, ruined the BIOS or whatever, I corrupted the entire thing with my initial hack because I was missing the whole point of the thing. I did pencils for an 8-page mini comic that I'm still not sure I'm happy with. It's okay. But the whole idea was to get you out of your comfort zone and try to just desperately get something done, even if it's not good. And because I was sticking to my system of doing things, my definition of this kind of thing, and not letting the event work its way with me, I wound up having not as good a time as I could have had. Let me put it that way. So these shakeups can be very, very useful, and it can be also very disappointing when you plant your hooves in the ground and say, I've got my system, I don't need to change. And with that, Rob, I don't think we need to stay any higher than this. I think we can go on the ground and start talking about tools. What do you say?
Awesome. I'm sold.
And I'm going to use the uplifting music for this one because we're both excited about these tools. Hit the ground and just run to the end of this episode. So we talked about TinEye Labs, talked about Morgfile, free photo search. Just did a search for fishing boats while we were talking, and a lot of great images pop up. This is super, super cool. I had no idea about Morgfile.
And there's another one called the hearing the URL on the show is going to be a bit rough, but it's called Flickr Creative Commons. That's a good one. And and some of these I think are similar projects where they basically try to wrap a search engine with some kind of, friendly user interface in front of like Flickr. Flickr is a common source for this because part of the model of publishing to Flickr includes defining the license of what you are publishing to Flickr.
Mm. So I try to do a screen share of this? I can try.
I don't know.
I'm going to try to do this.
Hey, and look there's at something.
Yeah. Is this it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Flickr CC. It's flickrcc.bluemountains.net/flickrcc/index.php. It will be linked in the show notes.
Exactly. So, we'll be testing you for memorizing that.
So these are Creative Commons images that you can use as reference material. Right-click and select Save Image for a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, there's a Pinterest button on here. I figured we were also going to talk about Pinterest a little bit.
Cool. One more to mention that's very similar is called CompFight, compfight.com. Just another one of those. And these are, it's nice because different people have, I have done searches for, and actually what I did, by the way, is I made a an auto hotkey script that searches all these. So I can just put in a search term and then it'll get blasted out in my web browser where a tab will open for each of these resources. So.
Oh, cool. Are you going to put this script in the show notes?
Yeah, I suppose I can. Sure. It's, I mean, it's really specific. And it's not that clever. I mean, because basically what I'm doing, there'd be a lot of other ways to script it. Okay. So let's see. I'll add it to my notes and I'll do something.
Okay.
Because if I share the auto hotkey, not auto, did I really say auto hotkey? Keyboard maestro. Wow. Keyboard maestro.
Okay.
Auto hotkey is a wonderful automation tool for the Windows environment. But yeah, I haven't been running that day to day for years now. But yeah, keyboard maestro. Anyway, yeah, I'll post something. But I may move it out of keyboard maestro.
People can just open these up in tabs themselves, right? And so, yeah, I'm looking at, I just did a search for hippo, and boom, tons and tons of hippo images pop up. Comp fight. Man, so there's, you know what's funny is I've just been a Google image search guy all this time. And mm-hmm. using advanced search techniques, I can shut off the screen share now. But I didn't realize there were other resources out there for this kind of thing.
I got one more curveball one that's really a genuine lean into art curveball, but I haven't tried it yet. But I'd be curious if I just noticed this very recently on a news release from DeviantArt. They've got a visual search tool called More Like This. I haven't played with it yet, but. You're going to run into more problematic issues regarding licensing now with this, right? Mm-hmm. Almost guarantee it. Yeah. So doesn't serve the same purpose, but if you're just looking for, you know, to channel surf for inspiration or whatever. Anyway, I just think,
I just heard about this too. So yeah, this is at deviantart.com. More Like This, a new way to explore DeviantArt. It's a beta. DeviantArt is proud to announce More Like This, a new way to explore DeviantArt. When you find a piece of artwork that you love, More Like This surfaces related artwork, artists, and collections. Ooh, I wonder what data they're using to make these connections.
Well, yeah, I mean, it could be a lot of things as far as the tagging of the artwork itself.
Who you're connected to, right? Mm-hmm. Who's following you or watching you, as they say.
DeviantArt. Sure. As far as the, I know there is some kind of like system in the commenting and whatnot. And, so there's data that gets generated around the images, but, it's quite possible they're using, a recognition algorithms too.
So I want to show everybody how this, TinEye thing works if they haven't used it yet. Cause this is really cool, Rob. I've been playing with this while we've been talking. So mm-hmm. go to multicolor search. And I'm going to put this is up on the screen. Yeah, you can see it.
Yep.
Okay. So I'm going to go click on a nice darker green, a little bit of a warmer green, and it just adds these. You can pick five different colors. And now I'm going to go ahead and go and pick a color of contrast, like a nice red. And it automatically updates the image search. Look at this. And it finds all these different pictures with those color combinations on there. How cool is that?
It's really neat where, I mean, you get a really good feel for that color palette because you get just a whole bunch of examples.
Yeah. Yeah, you really do. I mean, and obviously you don't want to take somebody's licensed or non-Creative Commons images and use them for your own thing, but you, at least you can be an inspiration point, right? It's like, well, let's look where the point of contrast is on these images. That could be a point of inspiration. You can see how these colors are interacting in an image to see if you even want to use that color palette, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, that is super, super cool. What else you got? I've got a couple stupid helpy tips, but I want to hear more about these tools because this is what's photo.
So this is a little bit along the lines of Asset Bank, right?
Okay.
So I'll do one more because it's super, and to me, it's kind of related. So I actually, for part of my process for, let's see, whenever I'm using color in a comic, like I did this for, I actually short-circuited this for Babies Love Comics because I actually only did sort of like one flat color per comic, but I actually have a defined color palette for projects, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'll have like a separate PNG image that contains the color palette. And if I need to, I'll make a vector of it as well so it can hang out with me if I'm in Illustrator working on the project or if I'm in Photoshop. I'm able to just use the eyedropper tool to grab colors. So
yeah,
very handy. Just like, it's like having my own primitive portable palette.
Yeah. And similarly, and I know we've talked about this before, but it's worth bringing up again is, for projects, I'll create digital photo morgues now as inspiration/color palette things where it's like, well, I want this story to have this kind of feel that I got from this particular TV show or movie or whatever. And I'll grab a bunch of stills from that thing and just download them all into a folder. And then when I'm doing my coloring in Photoshop, I have my, I create like a specific swatch. What do you call that? Swatch library?
You can get like a, if you put it all into one image kind of thing. Or,
no, I'm talking about like in Photoshop, I'll create a custom swatch palette.
Oh, right. Yeah. Swatch, yeah. Palette of swatches or whatever.
Yeah. I'll create my own custom swatch libraries for different projects. Mm-hmm. And, so I've got my base colors, but then in case I need to, just tweak it that much more, I just pull up that image bank from the folder. And I don't actually do like a sampling that I turn into swatches, but I'll just be able to pull up two or three of them and go, oh, wait, yeah, the green was a little bit cooler in these scenes. So I'll grab that green real quick and drop it in for some specific stuff. So yeah. What is this cool other thing that I'm looking at here, Rob, this Photofunia?
Oh, Photofunia. That was more silly.
This does look silly.
It is totally silly, but why not? Right. So Photofunia it falls into the category of, again, of if I need some podcast album art, I'll use this. And I found some fun ideas, but basically it's like someone doing interesting Photoshop tricks that integrate an image, typically the images of a face, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think they have sort of a face matching, pattern of looking for eyes, nose, mouth, that then it just automatically gets inserted in a layer with the filters applied in this image that you can then download. So it's just, whatever. It's a fun, totally silly, more distraction than anything. But
I see. So it maps your face onto the image or whatever face you show it.
And actually for a couple episodes back on the Polytechnicast, I actually used this to generate the album art. it was basically a picture of a poster to promote an event for the book Ready Player One. And I used that plus this to generate an image of part of that poster on like a super old fashioned TV. So, you'll recognize some of the Photoshop tricks of yesterday in Photofunia, but I thought it was fun, cause with that one, they added, it's like, it's toward the middle on the whole big grid of things. It's like this, this very old telly, I believe is what it's called.
Okay.
And, they're adding, they're desaturating the image, adding some lines and then a gradient for some shadow and then a Then a little bit of a hard specular highlight as well to make it, you know, look like it's on bit under the glass on this old TV. Anyway, totally silly. That's what I put it on. So,
you know. Well, I'd never heard of this one either. So cool.
And since we mentioned the whole batch of them, I should actually find, I noticed these in a, oh, right. I remember the source. I found a lot of these links for these, photo resources in a presentation on, what's that presentation portal? Slideshare. Yep. So there you go.
Slideshare.net.
Slideshare.net.
Another one for the show notes.
Yeah. And yeah, so SlideShare is somewhere where if you give a talk and you feel like publishing your deck, it's not a bad place. I mean, because it's a community full of people who want to do presenting, essentially, or who consume a lot of information from presentations, which it's more than you'd think, you know, at first thought, like thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to serve PowerPoints for my articles of interest today. But there's a lot of good stuff.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like these days, I mean, how many people actually watch TED Talks for fun, right? Mm. I know a good number of people who do, so possibly.
Good point. And some of these are, you know, they're talks by very, very talented visual storytellers and presenters. So anyway. Tell us about your stupid helpy tips, Jersey. I know you've got a ton of information on this as well, and the mountain of show notes that went into producing this episode became a mountain range only because Jersey created the first mountain and I created the second mountain.
We don't have to go pitching back and forth with credits on this one, but yeah, another thing that, you know, this digital mobility thing presents you, or rather, let's go from the mobility thing to the expediting thing. You know, just dumb little things that just speed things up for me so much. Like, for instance, I keep a template of an 8.5 by 11 letter size template of just blue boxes that are the aspect ratio of the pages for the story on which I will be working on. Right. So if it's a 9 by 14, you know, this is more of like the traditional comic size, but a little bit smaller, traditional comic book aspect ratio, or if it is going to be mini comic size, or if it's going to be something like the front story that I'm working on, which is more screen iPad aspect ratio, right? I work on a variety of stories in a variety of different aspect ratios. So I will take that image, I'll flatten that a page from that in Photoshop, and then I will shrink it down, put a stroke on it, a 30% cyan stroke, and then I'll put it into a 6-up grid on a sheet of paper, and this is how I do my initial thumbnails. And I save it as a template, print them out as much as I need to, and then I don't need to worry about when I'm doing my initial thumbs, did I get the aspect ratio right? Did I make this one too wide? And now I've got all the elements set up in a weird way. I don't know if this ever happens to you, Rob, but it happens to me sometimes. Like when I'm sketching on a page, if I get the aspect ratio wrong, I'll think I have more horizontal space in this panel that I don't have. And then when I go to final, I'm like, ah, crud. It's a dumb little thing.
But it bites me a lot, to be honest. I need to make sure the aspect ratio that I thumbnail at matches my target page aspect ratio.
Yeah, it's bitten me enough that I thought of this or maybe got this idea from somebody else. But anyway, it's just a Photoshop file I also do these templates in InDesign. Just a 6-up on a sheet of paper, and then I can just print them out as much as I need. And then the other one, which I don't have on me, I think I left it in my other studio. Whoops, mobility. but I think I've shown it on the show before, is I'll actually print up on, you know, a letter size sheet of paper, I'll print up a blue line template of the live area of the page. I'll take that aspect ratio like this, right? And then I'll blow it up to 1/2 of the page. Then I staple and fold, and now I've got the aspect ratio for my second round of thumbs. That's if you do 2 rounds of thumbs like I do. And then I take it to the next level with the final, like I mentioned earlier, I take the final Bristol. And this is Strathmore house, or no, it's Utrecht house brand Bristol, smooth finish, two ply. And the reason I use this is because it can go through an inkjet printer just fine. It doesn't get hung up. If you ever tried to run 300 series Strathmore through an inkjet printer, it can, depending on the printer, it can sometimes get jammed in there. This is a little bit of a lighter stock. It's a little bit more flimsy, which means that it can go through the printer just fine. So I make an InDesign or a Photoshop template of my live area with all the different measurements preset, cut in thirds, quarters, half, and et cetera. And then I can print the Blue Line live area, just like on, like, you know, when you get those pre-printed sheets from like Blue Line Pro or from Kablam or from whoever, you know, you got the live area all measured out with your different demarcations for half, quarter, and third. So I print that out myself on my sheets. And then the trick is with the inkjet printers, I will trim off a half inch from the side. So it's actually 8.5 by 14. And then I can go through my inkjet printer just fine, providing I set a custom page size in Photoshop or in InDesign. And then I'll print out a batch of those at a whack, you know, 6-10 pages at a whack. And then I've got some pre-ruled pages. I've got my pre-ruled thumbnails, second round of thumbnails, and my final pages for doing the final work on. So that's one. And then I just make sure that I save them. You know, I've got a comics folder on my external hard drive, on my documents folder on my Mac, and then I've got a comics folder on all the different cloud storage services that I use, like Dropbox, Box.com, and so on. And I just save those templates in all those places to make sure that there's always one someplace. I also kept one on my USB thumb drive, but that died recently. So now I got to get a new one of those. But I always try to make sure that those templates are someplace where I can get them. So reason I kept it on a thumb drive too is, what if I'm in a place where I don't have internet?
Oh yeah. So very interesting. The so you have like digital, it's just sprinkled throughout your process is what it sounds like. Cause it's helping you produce the, you know, physical paper essentially to be able to work on. But then you're probably at what point do your process, do you go back into digital?
Oh, well, in the case of this page that I teased earlier, you can see that I penciled it on the Bristol, and then this afternoon I scanned it, and tomorrow I'm going to ink it in Manga Studio. But I would, even if I wasn't inking in Manga Studio, let's say I was going to ink it with the brush pen or with the Crow Quill, I would scan it anyway, and then on the Strathmore... Or Strathmore. I keep saying Strathmore. On the Utrecht house brand Bristol, I would print out the blue lines, and perhaps we can link to the video. I mention this every time, but I made a video on how to convert graphite pencil lines into blue lines, either in Adobe Photoshop Elements or in Adobe Photoshop. I understand that the way you do it in Elements is similar to the way you do it in GIMP. So if you don't have Photoshop, you can still do it that way.
Review that. I mean, because really, so do you ever use like straight blue pencil or red pencil?
Yeah, of course I do. I mean, when I did the pencils on this page, let's see if there's a panel I can show that doesn't give anything away that I can't get in trouble for. But so when I did that panel, I mean, I did the stick and bubble figures with blue line. I did a rough approximation of the pencils in blue, and then I went lightly erase, and then I went back in with my graphite. Kind of uptight with that process, and I don't say that proudly, but yeah. So yeah, I still use
But you've got the thing that's working. See, what I was just curious there is if you were skipping the, like one of those, not because of, you know, cheater, it was more that, I had been doing a lot of my pre-sketch work in first, red, then blue pencil. And, and this is, I'll save this for the rest for the takeaway, but anyway, I did some sketching, with just, you know, graphite that I intended to ink. Normally I don't do that. Because it doesn't, the graphite pencil, if I just want to do a scan of my resulting inks, it's harder to make the, graphite disappear in a scanning process because it's too close in value, to the ink.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I thought you had, but that's really cool. If I might try doing that with, because the pencils feel so different, right? The graphite pencil behaves so much differently than the brittle, muted, challenging behavior of the red and blue pencils.
Absolutely. All these tools feel totally different and they require a whole new sensibility in the way you approach them, right? So like with blue line, and now if, it depends on if you're using non-photo blue lead, mm-hmm. right? Like if you actually get the non-photo blue lead, that feels one way. It has kind of a waxier consistency. And but mm-hmm. then if you just get the blue leads from like Pentel, like I use, I just get 0.5 and 0.7 millimeter mechanical pencil leads, just the blue color, which is still weaker or more fragile than graphite, but comes out darker than real non-photo blue lead, but it still works like non-photo blue. It has a little bit of a warmer blue to it too, I noticed. But that too, like if you use the same pressure on that that you use with the traditional graphite pencil, it's gonna crack and snap. And then I use for my penciling, like for the graphite penciling, I use a 2H lead, mechanical pencil lead, which is a very soft lead. So I can be, and I think I got addicted to this kind of lead because I was so used to penciling with such a light touch with the non-photo blue, right? Or with the blue lead. Working with that lead, because it's so brittle, it trained me to be very, very gentle with it. And I noticed that when I was using HB leads with my graphite, I would hope this is interesting to artists. I don't know. Anybody who's into like tool porn, you know, like art tool porn. I noticed that my pencil lines, my graphite pencil lines were changing as a result of that. So I switched to a softer lead, which gives me a nice dark line without using even a tenth of the pressure that I was using before. But then when I print it out in non-photo blue onto Bristol again, this achieves two things. One is that I don't have to erase my pencils because it's blue again, and now I can ink it with impunity and don't have to worry about, you know, getting rid of it at the scanning level. And two, if I screw up, I just print out another batch of pencils. So, you know,
I was wondering if that was the other benefit too, is that it gives you some resiliency. It's like you have a fallback stage.
Yeah, do-over.
And yeah, you've totally got it, because you may not have undo in the physical ink world, but you can still go back and have a bit of a reset and not lose all your work.
I had one instance, and this is the only time this ever happened to me. And you know, this is one of the reasons I do things the way I do in terms of, like, you know, managing a lot of digital files, is I was working with an inker on a project, and this was in the, I want to say like 2000, 2001, in that neighborhood. And as I said in other podcasts, I didn't have a fancy computer setup at that point. I had a Windows 98 Hewlett Packard that my wife and I shared, and I think it had 2 gigabyte hard drive, maybe 256 megabytes of RAM. You know, it was a very, very feeble, weak machine, even for that time. So I didn't have a scanner, so I didn't do any, like, very much digital stuff at all. So I'm working with this anchor, and I sent him, you know, I FedExed him the actual pencils. Here's the pencils, dude. Ink them. And they, you know, it takes a couple days to get to them. And then, you know, I wait a couple days. Deadline is looming. When am I going to get the pages back so I can finish the lettering on it and get it to the publisher? And I get a phone call from him. He's like, dude, I spilled a whole bottle of ink on one of the pages. And I had to re-pencil that page and then remail it to him and wait for that page to come back to me. This is an old man story. This is the kind of thing that, you know, it's like in my day, you had to do such and such.
Wait for the phone in town to become available.
Yeah.
My horse was tired.
We were on a party line, and then, you know, old woman Pickle Feather wouldn't get off the phone. But this is an old man story. But what it points to is that, yeah, part of this is out of a, there's still a scar from that week, you know, mm-hmm. and I don't ever want to go through that again. So, you know, having as many do-overs as possible is a good, good thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, your process is more resilient for that, which makes me think that that could be a topic at some point, is what are some of those, the creative process scarring milestones that you've adapted around?
Just as a catharsis?
I don't know. Like, maybe, I have no idea. I think there's interesting things like what you describe. Maybe some of the reason to do a scan. I mean, sure, it was because of a frustrating loss of work, but it's actually a really good idea because you can make a mistake and you don't have to pay full price for that mistake.
No. And I mean, that's something in my work in general that I'm trying to get more accustomed to, is not being so hung up on the stakes of every page. I mean, I find that what slows me down is the whole terror of starting and the whole terror of throwing down those first couple lines, because what if it's not perfect? And I'm finding that a neat, and this is another stupid helpy tip, and this has very little to do with our overall topic, but it's here it is starting in weird places in a project is what is like a stopgap that I'm developing or playing with in order to get myself out of that habit of, ooh, I don't want to. I think I need another break. I got to go up and have another cup of coffee because I'm not ready to start this page yet, because I'm nervous about starting this page. So with this particular project I'm working on, I said, you know what? Start on page 2 and start on panel 4, right? Because that way you're taken out of that cycle of, oh, starting is scary. Starting is hard and I don't want to wreck it. So then by the time I work my way back to panel 1, I'm loosened up and I'm realizing that, oh, don't worry, you can fix it in post. If it's not perfect this time around, you can fix it at the inking level. If you mess it up at the inking level, when you get to coloring it, you can fix it there. You're going to be looking at this page enough to have plenty of opportunities to sculpt it. You don't have to nail it exactly at the penciling level, because you're going to be touching this page so much, right? So
yeah. It makes a lot of sense. It's one of the reasons to have a process that has stages in it too, is the you can adapt and refine.
So, but and then the other thing I would throw on top of this is, by having so many different digital versions of your stuff, is another thing that I've taken as a habit, is save them in as many places as possible. Save them on a DVD, save them on an external hard drive, get some remote backup going. And then, like I said, I use all those different cloud services. I've got a comics folder on Dropbox, box.com. And what was the other one I'm using? Oh, I just signed up for Microsoft SkyDrive, because they give you like 7 gigs or something like that. And I thought, well, if they're giving you 7 gigs or whatever, I'm not backing up my whole system, but whatever project I'm currently working on, I've got redundant copies in all those places. And people are like, oh, that's a lot of backing up to do. It's drag and drop, right? It's just like copy the new version of the folder over the old version. Hey, you want to overwrite these files? Yes. I only changed 2 files, but I'm not digging into the whole folder. I'm just grabbing the project folder, dropping it in, let it overwrite the old one. And I know that I've got a current backup in all those different places. It's just part of my routine that I worked in at the end of my workday.
That's really cool. So yeah, you have redundancy even if a given cloud service goes belly up for a day or permanently,
right? Like, cause like Dropbox could change their terms of service tomorrow, you know?
Sure.
Not that I think they're going to, but they could.
Totally. Could be the topic of a hit movie. If Dropbox, essentially someone just puts all the servers on a semi and drives across countries. And I know their files are all mine.
And then they have to get Bruce Willis and Jean-Claude Van Damme and Steven Seagal and The Rock to go get him back. Oh, let's write this movie.
I really do want to see this movie, actually.
And Mr. T makes a cameo at one point in the film.
Excellent. Not getting me to fly. Right.
All right. Well, you know what? We are already we're over the hour mark. So
all right.
What say we zoom out? We'll have plenty of opportunities to talk about these other tools at a later date, but let's zoom out to, we'll rather close out to get to the takeaways, shall we?
What did we learn?
What did we see? What did we notice? What caught our creative eye this week as we were working on projects and things?
I'm scared of learning now.
I think I just watched our viewership dip down by 50%.
You know what? No way. That Robotech music will get you going. gotta be.
So takeaways. Did you have something for us, Rob? Like something that you noticed this week?
Okay, so last Saturday I was at
FallCon,
and let's see, I started to do my normal thing where I start doing sketch cards partially as a way to just because it's fun to draw, right? And also, I found that when I do sketch cards, it attracts people's eye to either what I'm working on at most conventions, not every one of them, because sometimes if people notice you're working, they don't want to engage or whatever. So I kind of gauge that, to either look, approachable yet busy or not or whatever, based on what seems to get people to, come over and chat or whatever. But also finishing sketch cards and putting them at strategic points around the table, it gets people to investigate my table. And quite possibly even ask questions about that sketch card. And because I just drew it that day, I feel really, fresh and ready to chat about that thing and whatever was going through my head or whatnot. I started doing that where I will generate a fair amount. I'm not the fastest artist, but I will generate a fair amount of sketch cards over the course of a tabling day. Jersey?
Yeah. What? What do you mean?
Nothing. I don't know if you have a comment on speed or anything.
You know my position on this. There's no speed limit or any kind of standard operating speed for this kind.
What I'm saying is, if on the highway of sketching, people are honking at me. So,
and you know what? I would call you a safe driver.
Okay, fair enough. I really actually, I went from like my normal, people are honking at me cause I'm going slow to, I went super slow. I actually went to a different, where the product changed, where I no longer was exploring, doing a sketch card and finding some kind of fun pose or playing with my characters or some other. Once in a while, I'll throw a fan art character in there, pretty rarely, but I do like to try doing fan art. And wanted to do two more. I don't know why I resist it, but there's a all of a sudden it hit me where I wanted to see how much, what I could get out of this drawing. Like where would it go if I just followed moment to moment urges and stuck with the pen for a long time? And how would I embellish it? How would it feel? And I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed giving in and saying, no schedule is stopping me here, right? I'm going to picnic on this highway of sketching and enjoy it.
Yeah. Drawing for the fun of it, and the fun of it can, we make a lot of fuss about setting up creative challenges for ourselves and setting up arbitrary limitations to see what happens. We spent a lot of breath this episode talking about self-learning and everything and how you got to push yourself to do that. And then there's just such a thing as doodling and noodling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just doing that for the pure pleasure of doing it and not, we have to remember that this can be fun sometimes too. So what was what did you learn? What was that for? What were you giggling at?
Nothing. It's fun to back off the challenge I basically went to something I was once comfortable with and it was totally normal because I didn't have any like production schedule or whatever. Mm-hmm. But so it was unfamiliar, but old in just, it's been a while. But at the same time, it was nice to pull off the limits and, get reacquainted with just enjoying going nuts on drawing, staying with it.
This is a very simplistic way of looking at things, but it's something I like to joke around about. Is like whenever you meet somebody who's like a jerk in the arts or the creative fields, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly not naming names. I'm just saying, like, we've all had that experience of meeting somebody who's not quite as nice as we would have hoped, and they're in the creative field, maybe in a place where we want to be someday, right? And I just think, you don't get to be a jerk if you're getting to make creative things for a living, right? You get to get up every day and you get to draw. You don't get to be a jerk about that, right? And everybody gets to be whatever they want to be for whatever reasons and rationale they have. But my point is that, that we forget sometimes that this stuff can just be delightful, as dumb as that sounds.
Oh my gosh. It was so fun. I mean, yeah. Hey, new good big news, everyone. I found out drawing was fun. That sounds so dumb, but it is. I just enjoyed the heck out of myself, just drawing and not forcing myself to finish that thing. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, it does get romanticized. The work aspect gets romanticized sometimes. You know, it's one of the things that I was thinking about, and this is another takeaway. This was something I was just thinking about last week. Is that I kind of made a promise to myself, a promise that I'm likely to break because I'm human after all. But I promised to myself that I wasn't going to publicly complain about how tough it is to be so busy, you know, and it actually came out of talking with a friend of mine. I talk with this guy every week, and he started off the conversation in a recent week with, so how you doing? And don't you dare complain about how awesome your life is. And I said, all right, I won't. And that was, you know, a good reminder to me is that, you know, from his standpoint, things are pretty good for me. So, you know, I wish I made more money. You know, I wish a lot of things. But the fact of the matter is, for the most part, I get to get up and think about comics all day. That's pretty awesome. And I don't want to fall victim to that romantic aspect of, oh, I put in 15 hours today. I'm a champion. I'm a hero. Let's try to remember that, you know, you're doing this because you love doing it, not because you want to flex your muscles in front of everybody about how hard you work. And besides which, we talked about expediting things in this episode, you know?
Yeah, it's more time for naps and
well,
long thoughtful walks. And I'm kind of joking, but it's actually napping that I found out is pretty good too sometimes.
No, you know what? That's another thing is like, I want to get my work flow to the point where I can actually afford to take naps. And when I do, that's what I'll brag about. I took an hour and a half nap today. I feel like $1 million. You know?
That's an awesome goal, man. I respect it.
All right.
Not that you need, I mean, it's just, yeah, I don't know. It stands in contrast to the goals you commonly hear, right?
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about like things, you know, you hear about these things like the happiness index of certain countries and like, I forget the country, maybe somebody in the chat, if anybody's in the chat, you can help me out here. There's some country in the east over around the Asia neck of the woods. Asia is the continent where they actually think about gross domestic happiness, you know, instead of gross domestic product, you know.
Wow.
I've been thinking about that a lot because I've been watching a lot of TED Talks about that kind of stuff, and I think, you know, is it such a foolish idea to think about that kind of aspect of our lives? Are we actually leading a contented life, and not the contented pacified life, but the contented I'm getting what I wanted out of this gig, rather than being the chest thumping gorilla saying I work harder than anybody else, look at me, you know, that kind of nonsense. So
I am so trying to find out. I found a Wikipedia on gross national happiness article there, but I am not seeing the country. So it was coined in 1972 by Bhutan's fourth dragon king, Jigme Singye Wangchuck, who has anyway. So, yeah, 1972.
Burma. John O'Ballier is in the chat of demophon.tumblr.com, and he said Burma. It was Burma.
See? Sweet.
Thank you, Jono. You are awesome. Thank you for participating and watching and helping me out in a bind.
Yes.
I don't know if that makes me a hippie or what, but it's something I think about now. So, you know, having
hippie artist, never heard of one.
Next week, we'll do an episode on why I'm much more conservative than you might think. No, no, we won't.
Anyway, I'm being silly, but
yeah,
I think we're wrapping it up, right, Jersey?
Yeah, and, I think we're done.
Aside from me distracting us.
So this is where I say, you know, you're back from FallCon. Good to have you back, Rob. We have to talk more about it next week. We'll talk about some of the different things that you learned there. So you have more takeaways to share.
I know that we're running long, but there was a takeaway about people stopping by.
Yeah.
Routine, or no, was that the thing? No, that was I don't know. I was trying to pull out see if you had a takeaway this week.
Oh.
I was looking at my incomplete notes.
I'll save it for next week. I was going to talk a little bit about public speaking, but I'll tease that out for the next one because
it's right. Just, that was it.
Yeah, I went and saw Lawrence Lessig talk, which was my version of a rock concert. Watching a guy get really fired up and passionate about copyright law and about corruption in government.
Creative Commons. This is this podcast partially brought to you by Lawrence Lessig, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know he's not the only one behind the project, but.
But yeah, right? But he's like a big, big voice behind it. But yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I had some thoughts on presentation style and about how, I've talked in the past about how on, what's it called, Gordon Ramsay, I'm really fascinated by the way he moves. It's so purposeful and he always seems like he's in full possession of himself and all that stuff. Lessig is another guy that I like to watch. I like to watch him work because he's and anybody who's ever seen his talks knows this, he's a grade A presenter, but also he does a lot of neat stuff with his body to misdirect you. So you're only paying attention to his voice in the presentation. And when you watch him, you don't see that remote going. You don't see him clicking the remote. You don't see him stop to go, what's my next slide? It's seamless. It's a seamless presentation that almost feels like a documentary that you're watching live. It's very rehearsed. But anyway, it got me thinking a lot about doing visual presentations and how it's not just about, there's still a lot going on there. There's the slide. There's the voice, what you do with your voice. And there's also what you do with your body. So...
Dude, sounds like a whole episode to me.
Kind of.
Yeah.
So, maybe we can dissect him at another time. But for now, I think Rob, you came in with a big sack of tools and dumped them all over the floor for everybody to sift through and see what works for them. So these will be in the show notes at leanintoart.com. And then I want to say, if you found this stuff useful, if you found this stuff interesting, if you are glad that you showed up to the live stream or glad that you put this on your podcatcher and put it in your ears or watched it on your screen, a great way to thank us would be to go out and go to iTunes and give us a star review. That's the best way to put us on the radar of other people who may enjoy this stuff too. If you're listening and saying, I can't be the only one who enjoys this, well, you're probably right. So the best way to tell somebody else about it, I mean, besides going and telling a friend, is to give us a star review on iTunes. And if you really, really enjoyed it, then to conclude our two-parter on Toward a Paperless Studio, if you want to try out some more digital neat stuff, you can go to leanintoart.com/workshops and check out our pick of the week, which we're going to repeat with, Digitally Organic Art by Kim Holm, which is an hour-long workshop where Kim Holm of denungaherholm.com, cartoonarchy.com, denungaherholm on Twitter, where he shows you how to create organic looking effects with digital tools. And the workshop comes with this huge bank of images that you get to use royalty free that Kim prepared for you, that you can start putting those techniques into practice immediately upon finishing the workshop. The videos that you get from our workshops are DRM free and never expire, so you can download it again and again and again if you want to. If you really want to be funny, you can go ahead and even pirate it. If you want to help us out, if you want to thank us for putting on this show every week, then the best thing you can do is purchase it for yourself and then tell a friend about it. But there's also the free option of just giving a star review on iTunes or giving this video, if you're watching right now, giving it a thumbs up on YouTube. That's another great way to help us out. So I think we're done, Rob.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. Good sprint at the end, Jersey. Good sprint.
Next time I'll tell the story about the one time I was ever in a race where I sprinted at the end. And I still lost. But
this time you won. We all won. Yeah, we won.
This time Becky wasn't on the sideline saying, oh my God, you're going to lose.
Trying to shortcut that. Yeah. Well, right.
All right. So, all right. Until next time, everybody, I have been Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of leanintoart.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for hanging out with us, everybody.
Yeah, thank you very much. I need to go back to the video link.
All right, I'm going to end the old broadcast.
I have an observation about leaners also, Jersey.
Do we want to leave it in the stream, or do you want me to shut
you know
off
what? No, we can leave it in this. Or yeah, don't shut it off. Leaners. I'm actually turning a corner on that one because add an R to leaners. Learners.
Oh, I was trying to figure out where to add the R.
Leaners. No, let's not learners. I think leaners. Perhaps. That's I don't know. Learners. I like that connection.
You too. Learners.
Yeah.
Leaners are learners.
I know. And
We're gonna have to stick with it now.
I have a huge warm spot in my heart for that name, where I've always been like balking at it a little bit, you know, like perhaps because I was always rhyming it with wieners in my head. But you're putting the effort in and you're a learner, and it just, I love it. That connection. And so as soon as that happened, I'm like, oh.
Yep. And with the other, you know, new secret thing that we'll be dropping in a week or so, I think the word lean is going to get used a lot more promiscuously in our branding, if you want to call it that. Hey, Dijusan was here too. That's awesome. Good seeing you, Dee. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Yeah, thank you very much. I actually, partway through, I closed the comments because I was worried that the video was going to start up for me. Mm-hmm. So anyway, sorry I missed you guys in the chat. But anyway, thank you very much for hanging out.
Oh, Jono corrected me. Now I have to leave this in at the end because we're going to get a yeah, but email. It's Bhutan. You were right first, Rob. It was Bhutan. And Jono just corrected himself on Twitter.
Okay. So. Well, I wasn't right. I basically, I read a Wikipedia page.
You still get credit. You read it first.
All right. I'm a genius. I'm sorry. I don't know. A little jokey today. All right.
All right. Well, okay, guys, I'm going to shut down the stream. Thanks again for hanging out with us. We will see you next Tuesday.
See you.
Adios.